The teaching you are about to receive has been freely offered to support your practice. If you would like to make a donation to support the continuation of our work, please visit us at awakenedheartproject.org.
So the topic I'd like to speak, the title I've made for my talk tonight is I Think, Therefore I Am, in Suris, meaning in a mess. In problem. That's a big problem here. Aina. So, in some ways this talk will sort of continue and be based, not based on, but will follow up the talk from two nights ago. And I'm very excited to be talking about this topic. I think it's sort of central to unfolding of human history and what's happening in our world and why things are so difficult in our world. And at the same time, it's directly the material that we can work with, this quality of thinking and understanding thinking. This is sort of one of the best laboratories for getting a grip on it. Because, as you've noticed, you sit here silently, a lot of thinking goes on. And since there's nothing else to distract you, except the practice of trying to pay attention to unfolding things other than thinking, but there's no distraction, so to speak, really, so just a lot of thinking goes on. So you get a chance to watch it and work with it directly. So I just taught a retreat a couple weeks ago with Sylvia Borstein. And she meant, I had forgotten that this was a story she told. I forgot originally where the story was, but because I had heard, and it turned out it was from Sylvia, that because this is an experience she had, that she was once walking on a retreat. She was sitting on a retreat where she was a participant, and she was doing the practice, and she happened to walk by her teacher for the retreat, Joseph Goldstein. And as she was passing him, he was talking to another person on the retreat, and the only word she heard him say was, "Nothing is worth thinking about." That's what she heard as he went past. Nothing is worth thinking about. And she says that she heard that and she was like shocked, you know, that this was her teacher. And maybe like you, she'd been meditating for years already, going on retreats for years, and there was a lot of thinking going on. And what she understood, so she heard that line, she didn't know the context of the line, but she went back to her cushion and decided, having heard that line, that she was just not going to think anymore. She was going to stop thinking. I mean, for the retreat, not forever. For there on the retreat. More or less that's what she did. She really decided to bear down on concentrating on what was arising moment by moment. And she said it completely changed her practice, sort of overall, the whole trajectory of her practice. That's when a big, huge shift happened. With willpower, she just decided, well, I'm just going to sit here and not think that. That's what she heard her teacher say. So I'd forgotten that that's who I'd heard the story from. And I sort of automatically had a few things I thought about when I heard that line. One from her, which was, I'm sure he meant on retreat. She didn't hear that, but I think he meant, but I don't know, I think even on retreat, nothing is worth thinking about. She says she asked him years later, he recounted the story to him, and he didn't have any memory of that particular comment exactly and what he meant at that moment and the context in which that line was only a partial statement. He said, which I had also thought over the years, but just to be, I think, cute, he said to her, well, Maybe nothing, right? Nothing is worth thinking about. Nothing. So I think the context for me is that is to work with that statement a little bit in the context of this practice, when you're on retreat in the practice. And even on the practice, even when we're here in this practice, first of all, I don't think Sylvia understood it right in the sense that I don't think at all the way to do the practice is per se try to stop thinking. It led to some good things. But I think if you talk to Sylvia about her overall practice, she could have. It led her basically into a period of really intense concentration practice. She started doing very intense concentration practice, and that did change her practice in lots of ways, and had some profound effects. Some of which were quite difficult. Yeah, there were some years where she was really struggling with things that were happening to her on the retreats, from getting to such levels, and then it would generate outside of the retreat as well. And in any case, there's a way, even, and I'll get to that a little bit later in the talk. There are ways to work with paying attention that do tend to mitigate how much thinking is happening. But you don't have to do it by trying to get rid of thinking. You don't have to try to stop thinking. You don't have to put so much energy. When you say it, there's sort of an aversive. There's an aversive quality there. I think Ruth used that language last night too. Then you're sort of having an aversive quality to your own experience, and you're sort of being unhappy with yourself. I also think there are certain kinds of thinking that are actually worthwhile to do when on retreat. I oftentimes on retreat will spend a certain amount of time where I'm contemplating certain things, contemplating certain topics. But I do notice for myself that I tend to do that towards the end of the retreat, when I'm really, as opposed to the kind of, like when I work on this kind of retreat, I'm sort of contemplating what I'm going to be saying sort of all the time. I'm watching my experience and thinking about my experience and thinking about how to put it in words and thinking about what parts of it would be worth sharing, because I'm in a little different role here. But when I go on retreat myself and I don't have to teach right away, a few minutes later, I do try to put off even that kind of contemplative thinking, which I think can be quite wholesome and quite helpful. I tend to try to put it off till later in the retreat. Towards the end, I start reflecting on what's happened and what have I learned from it. And so I'm going to play a tape for those of you who are staying. I'm going to play a tape of Ajahn Amaro, a whole talk he gives on thinking. Where he talks about how to work with it constructively and how to use it for contemplative inquiry, and so we'll get to that next week at some point. But I would suggest, this way I'd handle it myself, I would suggest that you not necessarily go to that early in the retreat, that on purpose, and that sort of gets to some more of this of the comment he was making. In that line, nothing is worth thinking about. I think one of the facets there is it's just not worth it, because there's a more productive way you could spend your time. It's not worth it in that sense. That it's more productive to spend your time trying to be present to what's happening and cultivating the witness quality of what's happening now, what's happening now, what's happening now. Because it's that witnessing quality that notices things that are arising and notices the reactions to them, including noticing thought arising. It's really a valuable practice to notice thought arising. And in that sense, rather than thinking about something, it's good to pay attention to the process. We're more interested in the process. And that's sort of the last line, the last word of that line, nothing worth thinking about, sort of the about part. So thinking might happen when you're on retreat. The content of the thinking is not worth that much time thinking about the content, not what it's about. But it's very valuable to watch the whole process of thinking going on and seeing how it's unfolding. And that's why I started to give this as a background too, because you can use the material from the talk of two nights ago as a way of reflecting on thinking as it's arising. So I'm going to say some more things about thinking in general. This is my intention to what to cover and help us further understand thinking and the nature of thinking. I hope to talk about recognizing the power and effect of thinking, the results of thinking. I'll talk about becoming sophisticated about thinking, which will include learning how to deconstruct our thoughts. And I want us to, and I'll talk a little bit, I hope, about how to put brackets around profane thinking. So there's some thinking that is actually really not helpful. And so I want to talk about how to work with that, how to put brackets around that kind of thinking. And I want to talk a little bit about learning how to cultivate sacred thinking. So using that language I've been talking about. So one aspect of there are ways in which I think my sense is that thinking is it can be very, very problematic, and so I sometimes talk about it in the context of a whole talk I give on the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara. So I'm going to do just a couple snippets of that that make the point in connection to what I'm talking about tonight. But I do think there's a way in which there's an aspect to thinking that where thinking is, one might call thinking the evil inclination. I'm not referring to all thinking, but there is a place where thinking becomes what you could call the evil inclination. And so when I started doing some work on that topic, I started thinking about the evil inclination, exploring what is the evil inclination. A number of you have heard me talk about that many times, some of you. And because I was interested in exploring, as I am tonight, what is it that sends us in the wrong direction? Why? And Judaism had a language for talking about that. They said there's this force, so to speak, they call it an inclination, and that we have an evil inclination. And the way when I first heard about that, it sounds like we have this sort of little force inside of us that's not good, and that's pushing us to do these bad things. That's how I understood the evil inclination. And I didn't like that teaching. I mean, I heard the teaching, but I never liked it. And so I started doing a whole exploration of what that topic was and what it meant in Jewish thinking and how does that work, and did I want to see if it made any sense to me if I explored it deeper. And I want to sort of go to the punchline of that, of what happened in that exploration, and I can talk about it with the exploration of that topic from a Jewish perspective. A way to do that is to look at the source material to see where it came from. And so the sages, when they talked about the evil inclination, there were two particular verses in the Torah that they talked about. They come around the story of Noah and the flood. So if you remember, very early in the Torah stories, there's this generation where everybody is evil. So it is a whole story about, it's the Torah's way of addressing the same question that we're addressing, that I'm addressing tonight. Now, where is this bad stuff coming from? What's this, you know, and what happened? What do we do with evil in the world? So the Torah is saying there is this problem that the whole generation became evil. And the solution in that story was to wipe it out, in essence, to have a flood. So the flood came to get rid of that evil generation. And since Noah was considered righteous, he built an ark and he was allowed to not be destroyed in the flood. the Torah verses in that story are, and the, if we study that and look at that, then we can get some insights at least of what the Torah is trying to say about the evil inclination. Jewish teaching also is that there's a good inclination. So they think there's two such inclinations. The word for inclination is Yetzer. So the evil and evil is Ra. So the evil inclination is the Yetzer Hara. The good inclination is the Yetzer HaTov. That very word of Yetzer is also the whole name that the mystics gave when we've been talking about this four worlds of prayer, that the world of the Vav that has to do with feelings and connectivity is also called the world of Yetzira. It has this, the same word. And the first time that the word is used in the Torah is in Genesis chapter 2, when in that related to that line I told you about with connection to the holy name and the breath that God breathed into the dust of the earth. That says that God formed human beings by breathing into the dust of the earth. And that's the first time that root is used, and it says Vayitzar Yudhei Vavei Elohim Et Adam, that God formed the man and then blew the breath into him. So that word Vayitzar is written with two yuds. This is a strange thing in the Torah. If you know Hebrew, you don't need two yuds to have that to sound out that word. So the rabbi says, so it's an extra yud. So whenever there's something extra, the rabbi say there must be some reason. And so they say since there were two yuds right in that very formation of the person, it must have been a sort of a double forming. God formed human being with two yet with sort of in a double forming with two basic inclinations. That's where they think about two. But and then the next two times the root word Yetzer Yud Sadi Resh comes is when in the flood story, which is sort of the next big story. And so in Genesis chapter 6 verse 5 it says V'kol Yetzer Machshavot Libo Rak Ra Kol Hayom. It says the entire inclination of the thoughts of the heart is only evil all the time, all day. It doesn't seem like it even leaves room for a good Yetzer. It just says it's all evil. But maybe you caught that word in there as I was saying it. It says the word thought. The entire inclination of the thoughts of the heart is only evil all the time. The next verse that where Yetzer comes up two chapters later says Ki Yetzer Lev Hadam Ra Min Arav, that the inclination of the heart of a human being is evil from youth, from childhood onward. That's sort of the literal translation. That coming out of childhood, it's just all evil. The inclination of the heart. So in this exploration, where I already didn't like the whole idea, that those lines bothered me too, and I kept looking into this whole concept, and I mentioned to my friend Sheila Weinberg, who I was teaching at the time, because I was actually working on a talk for a retreat like this, and how to work with the Yetzer, how to teach about this, I said, I don't like this. Doesn't make sense to me that there's a good inclination and evil inclination. I don't like that. And she said, "Well, the rabbis know that too. They say in the midrash, in the teaching legends about the text, and that's already an example. Even bringing that up is an example of what I want to get to in this talk, which is if you're going to make any headway with the text of the Torah, you have to not just stop with what it says." And so that's been going on since perhaps the mistaken event of writing it down happened. I'm going to talk about that a little more. The ways that Jews, since day one, have been dealing with that, probably even before it was written down, said, "Yeah, but it really means this." It says that, but it didn't. But this is what's really happening. So there's a whole body of literature called the Midrash, where they comment on each thing and everything that's interesting. They wanted to in the Torah and say this is what was also happening. It doesn't say it there, but And so in the Midrash, the commenting on these verses and this part of the story, the rabbis say, without the Yetzer, without the inclination, nobody would build a house or have a career or get married. And they don't say Yetzer HaTov or the Yetzer. They don't say good inclination or bad inclination. They just call it the inclination, not the Yetzer. And when she said that to me, that made much more sense to me. We have an inclination, and the inclination is what I already pointed out here. I think, in a very basic way, what the rabbis understood and what the Torah is trying to say is that human beings do have an inclination. It works like this: when human beings who have nervous systems and can sense things as being pleasant or unpleasant, when unpleasant things arise, the Yetzer says, "Get rid of them." And when pleasant things arise, the Yetzer says, "Go for it." And you could call the Yetzer the limbic brain. In the stories of the Bible, in the early story, which I'm about to get to, even before Noah, the story of Adam and Eve, then the troublemaker is also the Yetzer. It's called the snake. It's called the serpent. But what's the serpent? It's the reptilian brain. It's the same thing. This is the reptilian brain. This is the function of the reptilian brain. The reptilian brain sees an apple and it looks good. It says, "Go for it." That's how it works. And I think the point I want to make about that is that that's just the way it is. This is not good or bad. Good or bad has nothing to do with this. But we'd be naive to not think that out of the workings of this, good or bad doesn't result. If we just went for everything we wanted, you can see right away what problems that could cause. And if we try to get rid of everything and everybody that make us unhappy, you see the problems that could cause. But the problem is not in the fact that we want it or don't want it. That's what we do with it. And that's so then if you look at these verses, the two other verses I mentioned, so it says, the entire inclination of the thoughts of the heart is only evil all the time. So I think what it's really saying is the problem is not in the heart. It's not even in the natural. Not that our hearts are bad all the time. It's the thought process. I think a real indication there. That's where things start to go awry. So this is not per se the problem, that things are known as pleasant or unpleasant. The problems come in as the volitions form. Now those are the thoughts about what am I going to do about it, about this. That's where, and in the volitional fabricating, which is thinking, that's where some problems come in. And the problem, I think, is indicated, the solution to the problem is indicated in that second verse where it says, "Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra min ha'arav," which instead of translating that as the, now there doesn't talk about thoughts there. There it says, because the yetzer, the inclination of the heart of a human being, is evil. Now it says, literally probably means from youth on. But I think you could translate min urav, which means from his youth on. Could also mean from childish thinking, from I'd call it naivete, let's say, or childish consciousness. Or naivete, I like the word naivete, because if we're naive about this process, that this is going to happen, we're going to experience things, the reptilian brain inside of us is going to say, "Go for it, get rid of it." And then all sorts of thought processes are going to happen to sort of support that, because it's somewhat unconscious. If we're naive about that, how it works, either naive about how it works, or not paying attention at all to how it works, then the thought processes just sort of form themselves up, and we tend to start being pretty selfish and going after the things we like. Not so much worrying about if that's hurting anybody in the process, and getting rid of things that get in our way, whatever it takes to do that. That just unfolds automatically. And so then the thinking process, which turns this whole process into mental patterns called thoughts, and then results in actions, can cause tremendous suffering in the world. I think we see it all the time around us. So there are a few things we can do if we're not naive. So there's a quick list of a checklist of what to do in the face of how this works. So the way to deal with what the yetzer, and by implication, the way to deal with the evil urges that then get played out in the thinking process is, first of all, to recognize it. You have to stop and recognize, like, oh, these urges are coming up now. My mind is thinking these thoughts to go get this, to go do that, and you see yourself being angry or judgmental or critical. You have to just recognize that this has arisen. These states have arisen. So the first step is to recognize that something's going on with them. And it's not so hard to know that you ought to be recognizing, because if you, any moment you're feeling dissatisfied, you should probably pay attention to what's going on. When you're feeling dissatisfied, which could be wanting something or wanting to get rid of something, any kind of dissatisfaction, there's a good chance something is going on in this way. So you learn to recognize it and name it. So naming is the second process. If you're being judgmental, you notice, oh, judgment has arisen. Anger has arisen. Lusting has arisen. So you name the states. The third thing to do after you've recognized it and named it in the context of this practice is learn how to be with the energy of it. So and to do that, you have to practice restraint. So you need some restraint so that it doesn't immediately, so the volitional fabricating doesn't immediately play itself out in acting. So you got to have some restraint in the world of action. And you even to some degree have to have some restraint in the world of mind. So you have to not only be lost in the thinking process that's being negative or critical or lusting. You have to have enough restraint on that to cultivate a witnessing process, to name it, to be with it. And then as you rest with it, then you can get in touch, as we've been saying now, with the underlying emotions, start to feel what's going on, in which case you'll probably recognize there's something unpleasant, there are feelings that are unpleasant, or there's a grasping for wanting pleasant instead. You can start to feel that directly, experience it directly. And with the wisdom of insight, with the restraint and the wisdom of insight, then you can ask yourself, now, if I were to play it out, would that be good for me? Would that be good for everybody else? And instead of acting and reacting, then you can cultivate, as I said this before, you can be cultivating a wise, compassionate response in the face of this energy. And you can ask yourself, is what I'm about to do a wise and compassionate way to handle this energy? But you have to name it and be with it first to know what it is. If you can do all of that, then the same negative energy, you start to get wise about it. You start to see how it's a natural part of human beings. You start to develop a sense of compassion for your own struggle, for it's painful to go through this. But you also, from the wisdom that comes from watching it yourself, you recognize that when other people are acting unskillfully, they too are going through the same set of processes, and they're no different than you. You're not exempt from it. Maybe they're different maybe they're not paying as much attention, but if you're paying attention, good for you, and the card of compassion starts to open up to, like, oh, they must really be lost, you know. And when all that happens, then this same energy, which before was you were naive about and not paying attention, or perhaps not paying attention to, which then became the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, that it was just the same inclination, but it turned in a direction that causes problems. That same inclination, when you see it clearly, leads to compassion and wisdom and acting well in the world. So then it becomes the Yetzer HaTov. It's the same Yetzer. The difference is what you bring to it, the awareness you bring to it. So that's half of the talk, really. But there's one other thing. If you get lost in all that process, then sometimes you have to wisely duck from just facing how, you know, if you're facing judgmental thoughts and it's just so judgmental and you're paying attention and just like at some point you can't take it, then sometimes you can move to some other way to buoy up the spirit. So you can move to chanting or prayers or the blessing practice. A lot of you know I haven't taught it as a practice yet here. We'll do it next week, maybe later this week. But so there are other things to do as well. Now there's a way of working with in this practice that doesn't have to get as sort of as intense as the evil inclination, the good inclination. We can just work with just sort of moment by moment directly with the processes of thinking. We can just sort of start to pay attention to thinking. And partly we're using the practices we've been doing to cultivate some steady attention so that we can then attend to whatever's arising, and a lot of what is arising is thinking. I mean, we all notice that. But if you can... So one of the goals of practice, I think, is... goal is a difficult word. One of the things that can happen that's beneficial is we can cultivate some steady attention and then watch the thinking process unfold. So I want to talk about two completely diametrically opposed, but two sort of opposite ways of getting to this place, of working with this. I think I mentioned a little yesterday already, I did a retreat with a Burmese master, his name is Sayadaw Ujjanika, and the Burmese style is a fairly strict style. There is a lot of concentration practice, but very mindful at the same time, so you're always trying to notice what's arising in the mind. And when I sat with him, the question he asked on the first day, we had interviews, you go in, you have to bow down to him, and you bow when you enter the room, then you wait for somebody else to talk in front of you, then you, when you get to see him again, you bow again. And this was the first day of the retreat, and the person in front of me, on the first day, this was this question, he said, so when you, and we were sitting for an hour and walking for an hour, and sitting for an hour and walking for an hour. He said, when you sit for an hour, are you aware of every single thought that arises? And this was on day one. I thought, wow, that's a really high standard. You know, I mean, it's one thing to sort of be present, and then you drift off, and then you come back, and I sort of knew that. But he was saying, no, can you be so awake that you're paying attention, but every single time the mind would go off into thought, you would notice it. He didn't say anything about stopping thought. You know, he just said, are you aware of every thought that arises? He didn't say they shouldn't arise. He didn't say there should be fewer and fewer. He just said, are you aware of every one that's arising? I guess if you can get to that place, which he was encouraging on day one, yes, he was encouraging, if you could get to that place, then what you're really saying is that could you be in this place where it never sort of goes into here without you sort of noticing, oh, now it's gone into here. Oh, now it's gone into there again. Now it went into there again. Paying attention to the breath, and now this thought's manifesting. Now this one's manifesting. So, being a diligent student, I thought, okay, so I got to try to see if I can notice every single thought. Now, the way that practice worked, was sort of a fair question, was. He teaches very extensively a practice that I sort of mentioned, the practice called mental noting. So you, as you're paying attention to the breath, you constantly are saying, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. And that practice continues every moment of the day, that practice of noting. So when you're walking, he taught a five-stage process of noticing walking. He suggested while you're walking, you should be using the labels, lifting, moving, dropping, touching, placing. So as the foot's rising, you say lifting. As it's moving forward, you say moving. As it starts to go down, you say dropping. As it makes contact with the floor, you say touching. And then as the weight shifts into that foot, so you can push off that foot for the next step, then you say pressing. So lifting, moving, dropping, touching, pressing, lifting, moving, dropping, touching, pressing. So I would do that while I was walking. I think I said that's why on that first day too, I said dreaming about being in Hawaii a day earlier. Didn't I say that Monday night? No, like, I gotta do this for, you know. And eating, you're eating, and the same thing goes on, you're eating, you know. Okay, moving, touching, the cool, whatever you haven't noticed, you know, lifting, scooping. I said this the other day. So you just keep doing that. It sort of takes up all the slack if you do it. But not, you can't really be doing mental labeling and thinking at the same time. You have to stop the labeling to be thinking. Just like you have to stop attending to the breath to be thinking. But now you have sort of have two things at your side. You stop paying attention to the body and your side, and the label stops, which the effect it had on me was it was just really much more noticeable. When as soon as a thought would start, I would notice that the mental noting was stopping. So it was just gave me another anchor to notice the thoughts arising. So it did get to be the case where I could notice every thought that was arising, because it's a distraction from... Most of the thoughts that arose were not such kindly thoughts towards the teacher. The primary set of thoughts arising was somewhere in that direction. I was working really hard, and he was pretty demanding. You'd walk in there, and you'd walk in, the first question was, "Your progress, Jeff." He wants to know how you're doing on this idea of paying attention to every single thought, among the other things. That was only one of his suggestions. There are other things you had to do, too. In that retreat, because it was such an intense practice, I did notice that because I was doing that so steadily, I got fairly concentrated, stayed with it. And they also were asking us to move very slowly, really slowly. It would take me an hour to go from the meditation hall to the dining room. That's sort of how slow I was walking. And they were always saying in the room, walk slower. And he had, I could do everything slower. And then he had an assistant too, that another Asayadaw, but a Western monk, but who was teaching with him. And he would, you'd be doing walking practice, he'd be walking around, he'd be watching actually too. So you'd be walking, and all of a sudden you realize he's behind you. So you're like, you know, you really, like, you know, you don't ever let up, sort of. Sort of between that practice and doing it really seriously, and I would get to the place where not only I could notice every thought, but partly I could notice every separate thought, because like in an hour walk there would only be four or five thoughts. I mean, mostly was with it, and once in a while a thought would arise, and when it's that few you can also notice them all. And he didn't say there should be few. Maybe that's just what happened to me. I don't know how many thoughts anybody else was having in an hour. And then at some point on that retreat, after 10 or 12 days of doing that, I sat down in my room at one point, and the mental noting stopped, and there were still no thoughts coming in. And I wasn't actually concentrating on anything either. And I just sat there for quite a long time without a thought arising. And that was a pretty profound experience. It's an ephemeral experience. But from that perspective, every so often when a thought would start to bubble up a little bit, be noticed instantly because it was sort of so quiet in there. There was complete awareness. Now I can remember where I was sitting, the time of day it was. I was knowing colors and knowing shapes, and my eyes were wide open. I wasn't thinking about any of them, but I was definitely noticing things. I was wide awake, and once in a while a thought would come up, and it was really clear that the thought was the start of the self reorganizing itself in thinking. But because it would be seen, it was sort of like that game Red Light, Green Light. You play that game where you have to run from one side of the room and to the other, and you can only move... the person that was calling out red light, green light, stands on one end, and when they turn their back, they say green light, and you can keep moving, but as soon as they say red light, they can turn around, and if they see you moving, you know, then you have to go back to the beginning. Sort of like that, a thought would bubble up, but because I saw it, it stopped. and had to stop. You know, I didn't tell it had to stop, but as soon as I saw it, it stopped bubbling up. It would just barely start and be noticed. I wasn't noticing it. I was what started to maybe bubble up. So it was being noticed, not by me, but concepts would start to bubble up and then they would disappear. So it was a wonderful experience of no thinking. But the same thing can happen. The last long retreat I did, and I'm teaching as a teacher, I mentioned this with Ajahn Sumedho. I'm going to play a tape of his as well, because he sort of teaches how to do this practice without doing all that heavy concentrating. And basically he just says, just notice what's arising. now this is happening. And it's sort of geared in noticing the truth of what's arising. And somewhere around the same time, actually, after about 10 days, I was getting near the end of the retreat, but I noticed there was a resting just in the awareness of things arising. This was arising, this was arising, this was arising. But there was no identification with the things that were arising. So it took me into the same place. Things were just being noticed, but lots of things could come up, including lots of thoughts could come up, but they weren't my thoughts. They just were thought, now this thought's happening, now that's happening, now this is happening. And it still was just sort of, it was like a figure ground switch where the knowing was just resting in the awareness. That was sort of the phrase he'd use too a lot, you know, just practice resting in awareness, just rest in awareness of this and that. So, and I sort of started identifying with the awareness rather than with the objects that were arising in awareness. And so I didn't have to do all that concentration. Maybe because it came after I'd done that, maybe something was primed, I don't know. Right, now I'm going to do a short version of a talk I did here last year that takes this whole quality of thinking to another level of in terms of analyzing it. So it's a part of a talk I call "Exile from the Garden." And it's an explanation. It's one way of looking at this at the story of when Adam and Eve get exiled from the Garden of Eden. It's an early story in the Torah, since they're the first two people. So, if the direction I'm going to speak about now, if this is of interest to you, you could read a book called "The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind" by Julian Jaynes. I'm not going to talk so much about that book today. Last time I talked about it extensively, but what he points out in the book is, some of which is somewhat controversial. He makes some very shocking claims, but one of which I didn't think was at all controversial is that when our species began, we're this genus Homo sapiens, and for those of us who believe in evolution, we came out of a different life form. And whenever the genes mutated to make this current classification that we are part of, there were beings just like us walking around on this planet who did not have conceptual thinking. There was no conceptual thinking going on in their minds. And I tend to not refer to them as human beings, not as a put-down. I think we're human beings, the definition being that we are the same species, but we're beings that have conceptual thinking as our major processing thing that's happening in the mind, and that's what it's like to be a human being. But there were beings like us that didn't do what we're doing, that they didn't walk around thinking about things, not with concepts. They could learn, they could do many things. They had all the apparatus for learning speech that we have, but speech developed at some point. It wasn't a given. And as they acquired speech, it changed the way their minds processed data. And speech, it grew slowly. It grew over thousands of years. I think it only started 30,000 years ago. So, and probably there were hundreds of thousands of years where beings like us were not thinking the way we think. So keep that concept in mind that we didn't always have concepts. We didn't always have conceptual thinking. I think the story in Genesis, I think basically, this is my way of reading these, the beginning stories now in Genesis, which are stories about creation, are not really stories about creation, the creation of the earth. So the first line in Genesis starts out, Bereshit bara Elohim. So the first thing that the scholars have known for a long time, looking at that line and commented on, is that even though we translated it, we all grew up probably hearing it, that the opening line was in the beginning. That's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says in a beginning. This is a huge difference already, right away. It's in a beginning. So not even trying necessarily to talk about the first beginning. It's just a beginning. So then you can ask, beginning of what? And I think if you look at those stories, I think it makes much more sense to think this is sort of a primal take. Doesn't mean it's 100% accurate, but it's sort of I think it's a primal story that's trying to describe the beginning of human consciousness. Not the beginning of the earth, but the beginning of human consciousness. And I think there are a lot of signs in that story that you could understand it that way. And then that first line, the mystics understood that line. They go on from there to say, so it says, Bereshit, in a beginning, bara, created, Elohim, gods. Elohim is sort of the plural form for God. And when we translate it now in Hebrew, we say God, but Elohim is named for God, but it's clearly a plural word in Hebrew. It has the plural ending. The im ending is the masculine plural in Hebrew. And so the mystics, one way the mystics understood that first line was that in a beginning, which I think is the beginning of human consciousness, gods got created. Not the other way around. Usually you read it, God created, but the straight order of the subject and the verb is that some beginning created gods. This is one of the main points Julian James makes in the book is that we created gods. You know, the human being created gods. Meaning we created the concept. We created the concept that we call gods. And it came about sometime after speech. It wasn't the first concept either. And neither was the sense of self one of the early concepts. One of the interesting things he says about that, so speech started 30,000 years ago. So then you started having concepts, and the self is only one of those concepts, and he thinks the concept of the self is only about 3,000 or 4,000 years old, which is, that's very radical. So if you want to read his book and see why he says that. So for a long time, beings like us were having conceptual thinking, walking around, talking to each other, but they didn't think of themselves as having a separate self. That was a concept that arose at some point. I think it's easy to buy into that it rose at some point. When is another question. So, reading this story, I was reading this story in Genesis for preparation to teach in Asheville, because that was the week I taught in Asheville. It was in October, and it was Shabbos Bereshit. So I read I was reading the Torah portion, and I happened to pick up the Zohar. To look at it. I don't usually look at the Zohar because it's pretty complicated, but I look at it more now because there's a very good annotated translation of the Zohar by Danny Matt, who's doing the whole text and looking at every version of it and translating it and explaining what it means. So the Zohar is sort of like the big book of Jewish mysticism, sort of the first real but certainly kicked off the contemporary way of thinking about Judaism. And there are some older mystical texts, but the Zohar is sort of the most famous. It's only about 1,000 years old. It was written in the 1200s in Spain. And the Zohar is a mystical commentary, just like the Midrash was commenting on the Torah. So the Zohar is another commentary. It's reading the Torah and telling you what the Torah really means, the secrets. It's giving you the secrets of the Torah. And it's written in the form of a set of journeys that the supposed author of the Zohar, Shimon Bar Yochai, had with some of his friends. And they're traipsing around Palestine and talking about the Torah and saying all these wild teachings, which are really pretty hard to understand. It's not very easy to understand what they're talking about, because it's sort of written in code. And the code was 400 years later before the code sort of got published, what they're really talking about, by Isaac Luria, who lived in Safed in Israel, in Sfat. Anyway, so this is what the Zohar had to say about a line in Genesis that's related to this story of when probably you all know the basic story that there was this tree they weren't supposed to eat from, and the serpent told Eve it was okay. Eve told Adam, and they ate from the tree. And somehow related to eating from the tree, their punishment is to be kicked out of the Garden of Eden. So in verse 23, it says, "Therefore, the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken." So this is a verse that says really clearly that therefore, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh Elohim. Let's see how to say it. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh Elohim, both of those names, sent him, meaning Adam, forth from the Garden of Eden. That's in verse 23. And then in verse 24 it says, "So he drove out the man." But it just said it in verse 23. It said he drove him out of the garden, and it says, "So he drove out the man." So the Zohar, the authors of the Zohar, look at that and they think that's a problem. Why is it anytime, just like the double yud was a problem, this is redundant to say it in two verses right next to each other. So they assume it's saying something completely different, or else it wouldn't be there. So this is what the Zohar says about that verse. So Rabbi Elazar was one of Rabbi Shimon's friends. So they were walking together, and Rabbi Elazar said, "We don't know who divorced who, if the Blessed Holy One divorced Adam or not. But the word is transposed. He drove out Et." Et, precisely. And who drove out Et? Adam. Adam drove out Et. "Therefore it's written, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh Elohim expelled him from the Garden of Eden. Why did he expel him? Because Adam drove out Et, as we have said." So it's not sort of, it's hard to understand what's going on there. I think it reads a little bit like who's on first, you know. Who drove out who? He drove out who, you know. And what the Zohar does, so the words themselves, it says, "Vayigaresh et ha'adam," which means, literally means, as I said before, he drove out the man. It's not clear who the he is exactly. And what the Zohar does is it takes this word et. Remember you heard me say et precisely. Who drove out et? Adam drove out et. So et is a word that doesn't have any meaning in Hebrew. It's a symbol, it's a placeholder that's used in Hebrew as a placeholder to tell you that what's coming next is the direct object. So whenever you're going to say, the man, so literally this means he drove out the man. So before you can say the word the man, you have to say et the man. That just tells you that next it's going to be the, you know, the direct object, within the form. So it doesn't have, it absolutely, you know, nobody would look at the Hebrew and say, yeah, this is what et means. Everybody would say, et doesn't mean anything. And they say, no, that's not true. The Zohar, makes meaning out of this by giving et a meaning. And not only that, instead of saying, instead of the he being God who's driving out et the man, it says, no, the man's the one who did the driving out, and what he drove out was et. The man drove the et out. Now what's the et? So the et, according to the Zohar, is, now, this is a slightly contemporary understanding of what the Zohar is saying, but it says something like that. The et according to the Zohar, is all of conceptual thinking. That because it's Aleph to Tav. So the Zohar says that Et is an aspect of the divine called the Shekhinah, the feminine side of God, and it also is that part of God that results from all of conceptual thinking, and Adam drove Et out of the garden. Well, let me read you what Danny Matt has to say about that. He explains this a little bit more. Et, precisely, he's explaining that term. In the Zohar, Et is a Kabbalistic code name for Shekhinah, which is the last sphere. So it's an aspect of God. Expressing the fullness of divine speech, Shekhinah spells out the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph to Tav. So, and then he goes on to say, Adam drove out Et. The nature of Adam's sin is one of the most tightly guarded secrets in the Zohar. The language of Genesis 3, the garden story, understood was understood as hiding the true meaning of the sin. So the Zohar thinks that it's not really telling what happened there. And in essence, what the Zohar is saying, the way I understand it, is that when human beings developed conceptual thinking, then they started creating concepts which caused separations, and they started creating God concepts as well, and all of that caused for great rifts sort of in the unity of things, because now you had concepts that caused separation. So I think what the Zohar is sort of saying is that the sin of Adam was just the placeholder for primordial human beings. So primordial human beings caused, in creating God concepts, caused God to be separated from God. By creating God concepts, we caused for a separation that, that in essence drove those conceptual gods away from the real God, so to speak, which is not a concept. But the concept caused for separation. And then it goes, and Danny Mack goes on to say, in another place in the Zohar, Rabbi Shimon, this is Bar Yochai, the guy who wrote the Zohar, recounts a conversation that he had with Adam while he was selecting his future place in paradise. So now, supposedly the author of the Zohar spoke to Adam about this whole situation. See what happened? Now, I think that's sort of funny, but Adam just represents the earth element. Adam, Adama. Adama means earth. So Adam just represents, in some ways, that aspect of human beings that just comes out of our physical nature, which is really what this is showing, including some of our mental nature, every one of us can talk to Adam all the time. All you have to do is get back in touch with what it's like to be a being outside of conceptual thinking, which you can do directly just by noticing your senses. So it's sort of secret code, but I don't think you're supposed to understand it as he went and talked to Adam, the person. You know, but nevertheless, he says Rabbi Shimon talks about talking to Adam about where he'll sit in paradise. So Adam was sitting next to me and speaking with me, and he asked that his sin not be revealed to the whole world beyond what the Torah had said concerning it. It is concealed in that tree of the Garden of Eden. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a symbol of the Shekhinah. So Adam's sin was that he worshipped and partook of the Shekhinah alone, thus splitting her off from the higher spherot and divorcing her from her husband. I think another way of saying that is that with the origin of conceptual thinking, we created gods, and we actually caused the rift, and that the sin was that we forgot that we created those gods. You know, we forgot that conceptual. We didn't understand what happened to us when conceptual thinking hit, And it just sort of played itself out until we had these gods that got formed because of the nature of speech and language. And sort of the whole rest of history unfolded the way it did because human beings developed speech and language. And it was an unintended side effect of the evolutionary jump in the creation of language that that history arose. This is the whole sense of his that we call it, history arose, and that the fall happened. And we're in some ways still on that trajectory of the world falling apart because of conceptual thinking. See if I can come into some sort of hopeful landing. I think one of the things that the Zohar is showing us that we, in essence, giving us permission to totally deconstruct language. That if you just stay with language the way it is, we'll be stuck believing what we believe. So one of the conclusions I'd like to say is that don't trust anything you think. You certainly shouldn't take it on, and for sure you shouldn't take it on face value. And in some ways what the Zohar is showing is that even in our tradition, even what you think of as the absolute most holy language, that sort of we inherit this sense that, oh, the Torah is like, this is sacred, it's still language, but it's sacred language. Even the Torah you should deconstruct. If you take the Torah on its simple level, it wouldn't be worth staying with it. So you have to completely take it apart. But if you can even take apart the concepts of the Torah, shouldn't we at least do that much with our own thinking? It's just conceptual thinking. So I think what I'm trying to say then is that moment by moment, you shouldn't just take on face value anything you think. And in order to even get to that place, part of the practice we're doing is you have to get back in touch with your earth element, or Adama. You have to be able to be grounded in what it means to have a body and be in touch with it. You can have the possibility of direct access to non-conceptual experience. Every time you just sort of know what's happening without labeling it, you're getting closer to the reality of what it's like to be Adam, to be a human being, before conceptual thinking. And from that witnessing quality, whether it comes in the rarefied form I was describing, so thinking stopped long enough that then there could be a resting in the place that was just watching thinking arising, either in an extreme way or then it happened in just by dropping into watching, that you step out of enough that you can watch your own language, your own thoughts coming up, and start to deconstruct it. Don't take it literally. And you even know in certain ways what to discount. Like if you see yourself wanting something, you have thoughts of wanting. It's just this process going on. It's just because you have a nervous system that's automatically going to start wanting to get rid of unpleasant things. But you don't have to take that seriously. Just you don't have to believe that thought that, oh, shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't be that way. I don't want this. I don't like that. And you shouldn't necessarily believe the thought "I." I is a pattern of volitional fabricating that gets put together to create somebody to protect, so that that supposed somebody then knows how to not have stuff happen to it. But it's all just a strategy for not having this happen. There's a way we can in this practice just to keep deconstructing, and then try to see clearly, because. The point is not to get rid of conceptual thinking. That's why I like that both of those teachers, no one said don't think. It just said notice. Are you aware of every thought? If you're aware of every thought, then you can see what the thought is and how it's working. So there's nothing wrong with thinking. We're not going to stop. Conceptual thinking is not going to stop for any of us. Even if I say in a rare... that you could have such a rarefied experience, but I guarantee you, since then, I've had plenty of conceptual thinking, probably just as much as everybody else did. So for 1 hour, there was a little less, But it was an important window into that, but so the point is not to stop conceptual thinking. point is to become awake to it and aware of it, know how it works, and then we can elevate it. And then that's why I've been talking about this concept of sanctifying. So then we want to take the fact that we are beings that have conceptual thinking, and having weeded out the factors that might be causing problems that then are leading to mundane thinking or profane thinking, we can then try to elevate and have and use our thinking in a sacred way. And that's, in essence, what Ajahn Amaro is going to talk about when he talks about using thinking constructively. So there's a contemplative way to use thinking to help us grow, help us see more clearly. But if that thinking is happening in a way that's self-serving, you probably should go, oh, maybe that's not it. So let's sit for a minute.